Where's the committee?
Good, good to see you.
It's back in
Jacksonville.
Okay.
Good.
The housing.
Good.
Inspiration.
Good.
And, so I have...
Good. Good afternoon.
Did you get a chance to ask questions?
On?
Yeah, I talk loud. They should be on.
Good afternoon. I'd like to get started. It's Wednesday, January 14th, and this is the meeting of the Committee on Health, Human Services, and Housing. Chair Sharon is at the Child Protection Task Force meeting today and unable to be here, and so she asked if I would chair this meeting. A couple notes on our meeting today. We do have to finish right at 1:30 because Transportation Committee meets in this room right after ours, so we will be finishing punctually at 1:30. And in light of that, I'd like to remind our speakers to keep your presentations brief. We'd like to move on to the update on Ebola and the flu at 1 o'clock, even if we aren't finished with the health equity presentations. So keep that in mind as you're discussing, as you're presenting to us. We did want to leave time for members to ask questions. And so, again, if you can keep your presentations brief, that allows us to ask questions. So, first, we have an update on health equity efforts from the Minnesota Department of Health. Commissioner Ellinger and Acting Assistant Commissioner Jean Ayers. Welcome and please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Ed Ellinger, Commissioner of Health, and I really appreciate that you're having this hearing early on in session because we see that advancing health equity is the central challenge for public health in this state and actually throughout the country. And we also think it's a central challenge for Minnesota as a whole if we are going to continue to be a healthy and prosperous state. And when I'm speaking of health equity, I'm really speaking about everybody should have the opportunity to be healthy, regardless of your zip code, your race, your ethnicity, your language, your sexual preference, or where you live in the state. We see that as what public health is all about, that everyone has the equal opportunity to be healthy. And dealing with equity has been, as a pediatrician, I've been really dealing with this for my entire career. In fact, looking back at when I started with the Minneapolis Health Department back in 1980, we did the first report on disparities in infant mortality. And we've done multiple reports, we meaning the public health community, over the years. And despite a lot of really good efforts, many of which we have funded through the State Health Department and others, partners throughout the state, some really good work on addressing disparities and have made progress, the disparities persist, which tells me that we really need to take a different focus. We really need to expand our approach, that it's not just about programs. It's not just about access to care. It's not just about delivering culturally appropriate care, all of which are really important and we need to do. But it's really looking at the policies and the systems and the physical, social, and economic environment and how they disproportionately impact some populations over others. It's about looking at how we interact with communities that are disproportionately affected by a lot of those factors. It's taking a health in all policies approach. It's changing how we do business on a day-to-day basis. And it's really about having health equity be part of all of the work that we do as an agency, and I think all of the work that all of the agencies do in their world. We took this approach from our Advancing Health Equity report, which we delivered to you last session, and we know that advancing health equity is a major undertaking. And today we're going to hear some of the work that has emanated from our advancing health equity effort. We're going to start by hearing from some of our partners in this. It's a large topic. We could have lots of people here, but really just wanted to crystallize a few topics. Melanie Peterson-Hickey, who is our acting director of our Center for Health Equity, is going to introduce our other speakers. And then we'll Jean Ayers, the Assistant Commissioner of Health, who's been leading our health equity efforts from our executive office, will give some background and context for this. So I will turn it over now to Melanie Peterson-Hickey, our interim director of our Center for Health Equity.
Thank you, Ms. Peterson-Hickey.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Melanie Peterson-Hickey, and I'm the Acting Director for the Center for Health Equity at the Minnesota Department of Health, a position that I've held for the past 10 months. Prior to my current position in the Center for Health Equity, I served as a research scientist in the Center for Health Statistics at MDH, where much of my work was directed at reporting on the significant disparities in health and social conditions that exist between populations of color in American Indians and whites in Minnesota. I'm a tribal member, a member of the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe Indians in Wisconsin, and have lived in Minnesota for the past 25 years. I'm here to provide a brief summary of ongoing activities at the Center for Health Equity that includes the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative, the Center for Health Statistics, and the Office of Minority and Multicultural Health. I'll also be introducing a few of our community partners and our efforts to advance health equity in Minnesota. Since releasing our health equity report in February of 2014, MDH has created a new Center for Health Equity within the department. The goal of the Center for Health Equity is to help us to incorporate health equity into the day-to-day work, the day-to-day activities of our department, such as the grant programs that we administer, workforce development, and policymaking. The center engages communities to address structural racism and inequities that contribute to those health disparities. We collect, analyze, and share data on health inequities that exist in Minnesota. We invest in reducing and eliminating health disparities through the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative grant program. We are about increasing cultural understanding and deepening relationships with communities while engaging citizens in decision-making places. The focus for the Center for Health Equity is on creating opportunities for health for all Minnesotans through a health in all policies approach. The Center for Health Equity also has a lead role in the implementation of the recommendations from the Advancing Health Equity Report to the legislature, as the commissioner mentioned. While the report named a broad set of recommendations that require a wide array of partners and strategies, it also called for the Minnesota Department of Health to change and improve the way that we do business. And we've taken those recommendations to heart. Just a few examples of the work it is that we're doing. Divisions and programs across the department have created health equity work groups and action plans, some of them updated monthly and shared at their quarterly meetings. We've redoubled efforts around hiring and have dedicated some staff positions to working with particular communities, those that experience those greatest inequities. For example, the American Indian SHIP and Tobacco Prevention Planner positions, and a planner who works closely with our Refugee Health Coordinator. We are focused on strengthening our capacity and efforts on community engagement. A couple of examples there: the Office of Statewide Health Improvement Programs, SHIP, embarked upon an extensive 12-month community engagement initiative with the tribes in Minnesota to inform the redesign of the obesity and commercial tobacco prevention grants to reflect the needs of the tribal nations in Minnesota. Also, the Infectious Disease Program has a health education mini-grant program that is particularly focused on being driven by the community. We've also been looking at ways to collect, analyze, and report data differently than we have in the past. This includes looking at the bigger picture of how to better collect and integrate race, ethnicity, and other social factors into our data sets. I'm really excited and energized about the health equity efforts because even though the task at hand seems large, even monumental, I believe that we're finally on the right path. And as a result of our work, I hope that to be able to say that in the reports that portray Minnesota as one of the healthiest states in the country, that we can also say this is true for our populations of color and American Indians. It's now my pleasure to introduce to you two of our community partners in this effort who will share some aspects of their work around health equity. Chris Rhodes, the executive director of the American Indian Cancer Foundation, has been part of the process for redoing grant making at MDH to more effectively reach communities that have been impacted by health inequities. And Vajong Mua, who is a member of the Healthy Minnesota Partnership and will highlight activities around health and all policies. We've also invited two other partners to be here with us today. Monica Hurtado, who is a leading advocate for the collection and analysis of REL, race, ethnicity, language, data, was unable to be here because of jury duty. She has submitted her written comments for your review. Amana Dubay is a director at the Brian Coyle Center of the Pillsbury United Communities in Minneapolis, and he has been a grantee of the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative that has served over 65,000 people, not his program alone, but all of the EHDI grantees as a part of their programming. Amano was unable to be here today due to unforeseeable circumstances, so we have two speakers, and I'll just ask Chris to go ahead and begin.
Thank you.
Thank you, and welcome, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Hi there. I'm Chris Rhodes. I'm the executive director of the American Indian Cancer Foundation. I'd like to say good afternoon and thank you for this opportunity to Madam Chair and the members. As we've heard today, health equity is the opportunity for all people to achieve their highest possible potential for health, and that is currently not available for all Minnesotans. The impacts on health equity are clear. American Indians in Minnesota face some of the most stark inequities in issues such as income inequality, unemployment, educational achievements, children in out-of-home placements, home ownership. The list goes on and on. And we know that these work synergistically and show up as high incidence of chronic illness in our population, often even more so than some of the more visible risk factors that we would think of. One example that I deal with every day is while every other population has celebrated decreasing cancer mortality rates over the last 20 years, the American Indian population continues to have increasing cancer mortality rates. The American Indian Cancer Foundation is committed to eliminating cancer burdens for American Indians through education, improved access to prevention, screening, treatment, and survivor support. And one of our initiatives at the American Indian Cancer Foundation is a tribal health equity project, which is taking cancer prevention upstream. Sometimes people think way upstream. And we have aims to support policy systems and environmental change strategies to impact health equity, cancer prevention, and healthy norms within American Indian communities. In these efforts, we partner with tribal nations and urban American Indian communities to engage, empower, and educate communities for action and innovation through collaboration, community conversations on these topics, coalition building, capacity development, with a focus on influencing tribal policy. Health in all policies at its core is an approach to addressing the social determinants of health that are the key drivers of health outcomes and health inequities. As social and cultural norms vary across our Minnesota populations, we need to engage stakeholders that are from the communities to identify norms and common beliefs that contribute to advancing health equity or have potential value in creating viable solutions. Too many state policy discussions are being held without the inclusion of the communities that are most impacted by these decisions. The Minnesota Department of Health has made great strides with the development of the Center for Health Equity and the many initiatives tied to the center. I am strongly impressed with the wise and strong leadership of Commissioner Ellinger and Assistant Commissioner Ayers. I have a great deal of respect for the commitment demonstrated by this department, along with Dr. Peterson Hickey, leading the effort. It's critical for MDH to continue to engage with community leaders and representatives of populations experiencing the high levels of health inequities. Best practices related to health improvement and disease prevention are known to be generally ineffective in most American Indian communities. So without the right people at the decision-making table, the core of these issues are not being addressed or even understood, largely. In order to support efforts of organizations working to improve the health of traditionally underserved populations, the MDH grant-making process must reflect relevant input by a diverse range of stakeholders, including American Indian nations and urban communities. RFPs that are written by an individual or are reviewed by a small group will probably not reflect the actual needs and capacities of the potential applicants that need the most support because they are the ones who are taking on the exceptionally challenging issues such as astronomical smoking rates, poor nutritional status, alcohol and drug abuse that are all really just symptoms of some deeper issues that are population level that are not being addressed. The barriers of structural racism that have persisted have sometimes made grant-making and decision-making processes exclusive. And inclusion of strong and knowledgeable voices that represent diverse Minnesota communities will contribute to advancing health equity in Minnesota. So in closing, if Minnesota is going to be successful in advancing improvements in population health and closing health disparities gaps, we'd like to see a cross-sectoral and cross-cultural partnership and meaningful collaboration that involves a genuine sense of shared responsibility in really achieving health equity.
Thank you. And welcome, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Vajong Mua, and I'm with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota's Center for Prevention. And although we insure one-third of Minnesotans in every county, it's clear to us that health equity is a broader community issue, and that for us to be serious about advancing health equity, we actually have to address health where it begins. And we know that only 10% of what creates health actually occurs within a physician's office. The other 90% is occurring where we live, where we work, where we play, where we learn, and also how we get to these destinations. And so if we have this understanding that 90% of health occurs in the community, in the broader environment, it then follows that we need to insert health equity considerations and priorities into these traditional non-health areas, such as housing, transportation, food access, and education. And so you already heard the concept of health in all policies earlier today, and I want to riff off that and expand on that a little bit and give you a sense of what it means and how it can be applied to specific public health strategies. Earlier, the commissioner talked about how a health in all policies is needed because we detect sources and long-term solutions for health equity in non-health sectors. And so we want to make sure that as we look at, for example, transportation, we're looking at how can transportation either help or hinder health equity. And so we at Blue Cross, we want to make sure that we're looking at supporting biking and walking, transit, ADA compliance, because we see that active and equitable transportation is a way to support community members to and from healthy destinations such as healthy food outlets, farmers markets, grocery stores, to a doctor's visit, to school and to work. We also obviously see the cardiovascular benefits of biking and walking, but the point I want to impress upon you is that we see transportation as a public health policy, if you will. It's not only a public health policy, but there's a clear connection to that. There's a clear opportunity this session to support these active and equitable transportation elements in transportation policy this year. So that's just an example of how can we actually approach health equity in all policies and applying it to a non-traditional health area. I also want to try to apply this to healthy food access. And so it's important that we see food as a source of nutrition, but also as a way to support long-term health equity. This last fall, Minnesota, in partnership with Blue Cross, MDH, and multiple community advocates, came together to create the Minnesota Food Charter. And I won't give you the details of the food charter, but it's significant to note that the food charter's process included deep community engagement with diverse cultural communities, and it really represents a mosaic of different cultures, different disciplines, different sectors, and it gives us a roadmap for how to create a healthy, safe, and affordable food system. So I invite you to take a look at the food charter at your convenience. I want to end my remarks by showcasing how health equity in all policies can be also a process and not just being applied to single issues. The Department of Human Services has a very unique and innovative council. It's called the Cultural and Ethnic Leadership Communities Council, where a group of external community members are advising Commissioner Justin on how to advance health equity within her own agency. So this group is charged to analyze and look at the health equity impacts of all its programs and services. And I think it's a great model for how government agencies can have institutionalized community engagement. And so I just want to lift that up as a great example of how state government can authentically engage with diverse cultural communities. Last of all, I wanted to lift up, quite literally, lift up the health equity report here. It came out last year, and it's not often that I get a chance to describe a state government report as being inspiring and groundbreaking. And that's with all due respect to MDH and all the previous government reports, but it is garnering the applause and support of many health equity advocates across the country, precisely because it is pointing out root causes and structural barriers around health inequities. And it's framing it as not just an individual or programmatic issue. But in addition to that, it has some very strong recommendations on how we can go forward in terms of applying health equity to different sectors, different issues, and how do we organize ourselves amongst different cultural communities, among different sectors. And there's a great blueprint here for how we can truly advance health equity in the long term. And again, I invite you to dive deep into this. I do come from a oral tradition, and so I probably went off my script, but I wanted to make sure that you got the key points here, that health equity in all policies is a broad and innovative approach to advancing health equity. It is comprised of strong collaboration, especially with non-traditional allies. It has a strong community engagement component, and it's about inserting health equity criteria at the front end of decision-making. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. Now I'd like to see, are there any questions that members have for the presenters? Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
Okay, we changed things around.
Okay. And please introduce
Madam
yourself.
Chair, Jean Ayers, Assistant Commissioner. I would ask you to just pull a PowerPoint that we had here that we are not going to show, but there are elements of this PowerPoint that I do want to put in your hands. What we really have, advancing health equity is a very complex and interwoven issue and challenge, and what we've really boiled it down to is that we believe at the Department of Health, anyway, we have three primary tools that we can use to build our capacity for health. One is to purposefully expand our understanding of what creates health to include the opportunity for health. And you've heard speakers reference this. The second is to engage communities in decision-making to create their own healthy futures. And we have a number of different tools from data to reports and policy, education, to do that. And the third is the health in all policies approach that we talked about. There is a set of sort of overall lessons that we've taken away from this last year and a half of work. One is that this is very organic work, and some of these things sound soft, but they're actually what our experience has been. It has to be interwoven with all of our other work. Our work has to be intentional. We actually have to be thinking about health equity every day in everything that we're doing. We have to make a commitment to actually build our skills and our experience. And sometimes I use the term we have to build our muscle within the agency to be able to do this work. And begin to hold each other and ourselves accountable. We recognize that this is incomplete work and that we're imperfect and that we are actually, rather than we haven't arrived at a destination, we are navigating toward an opposite shore of where we want to be. So we're thinking about it that way. We are willing to lead, but we do need partners. And so what I have is this, there's a set of 12 slides in this PowerPoint, which actually just highlight the key points of what we mean when we're saying we need to expand our understanding. And I'm inviting you to begin to have those kinds of conversations with your constituents, with your partners, with other policymakers. Basically, we talk about what creates health, what determines health, what those prerequisite conditions for health are, the fact that Minnesota is doing well, but that there are inequities, that those inequities can be there's a pattern of a racial dynamic around those inequities, that you can look at any particular disease, and often this committee probably does. We're going to think about strokes, or we'll think about diabetes, and every single one of them you're going to see those kinds of patterns. And that means that this is really related to some root causes, and that they're predictive of the future as we go forward, and that those root causes are grounded in structural processes and structural inequities that get perpetuated, and they're not external from wherever we are. There's obviously something we do collectively, but it's also something that we do right in our every single program. And that we have discovered or are finding that it's really helpful to begin to develop the discipline of asking a set of questions. And we've listed these questions here in terms of the questions that we use to inform the report. But I've also provided you a handout of a set of questions that you as policymakers can just be asking to expand the conversation as you're considering policy around school discipline or as Vajong said, transportation or public safety, any of those kinds of things. If you ask these questions, you'll find that you're able to move toward healthier public policy making. I want to give one example of what we did in the agency. Part of what we've been trying to do is create permission to interrupt our processes, because we do get kind of, we're risk averse. You might not know. We're risk averse, and we don't want to make any mistakes, and we have an agency of experts. So we are trying to say it's okay if we discover we could improve something to stop right now and improve it. And one of the things that happened is you passed the safe harbors. And we were moving forward with a request for proposal around putting out the grants to reach out to prevention around sex trafficking. And we took an approach which we believed was good, which was we want to be sure we covered geographically the whole state. And because this work had been going on in the agency, the grant reviewers, the people after the whole thing had gone out and people were applying and everybody's reading the grants, and usually that's the point of the process where it gets kind of locked down. Staff contacted us and said, we're looking at these grants, and it's apparent that there's no one who is able to connect and or reach the American Indian community. And it was like, oh, because we took a geographic approach, which made sense, we had just created and were ready to perpetuate a structural barrier for the community that is actually experiencing the highest levels of sex trafficking. And so the staff asked for permission to interrupt that process, and we had to talk to the legal department and do all those kinds of things, and they did, and they were able to talk with tribes and find a way to come out with a solution that would be able to meet those needs as well. That happened because we're giving permission to interrupt the process, because we're using this set of questions, and because we're distinguishing between intent and outcome. So I'm just inviting you to join us as partners in using these kinds of questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Did you have further remarks?
Now we're open to questions.
Okay.
Either
great.
For us or for the other two presenters that were with us.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Hayden?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Peterson-Hickey, right? Or no, I'm sorry.
Peterson-Hickey.
Commissioner.
Assistant
Gene
Ayers.
Gene Ayers. I'm sorry, Ms. Ayers. I should know your name better than that. So I'm very intrigued on, and first of all, I want to say thank you for the work that you guys have done. And I like the idea that you're kind of involving your staff kind of up, top to bottom in this process. And if someone sees, if I heard you right, someone sees that there might be an omission or they hear from a community member, that you're able to kind of disrupt or stop or challenge the process, and no matter what it takes to get it right. I think that is fantastic. The question I would have is, what are the things that we're doing once you learn that so that you don't have that disruption in the process and that you hopefully get it right from the beginning? because intuitively, I would have always included just me, American Indian folks, in an issue around sex trafficking, because everything that I've heard and read in this committee and others would say that that's the target population. So I'm not kind of blaming because you missed it, because you caught it, but how do we kind of stop catching it and intuitively do these things for the target population? Because my concern would be, what if you hadn't caught it? So how do we, what's the learning that takes it just a step further? And I don't want this to sound negative, because I do think your process is much better than it's been, but how do we incorporate what you've now learned into the next RFP or the next proposal?
Ms. Ayers.
Madam Chair, Senator, thank you for that, because it does, that question is that I think one of our key approaches is to open up as much of our decision-making processes to a real true partnership wherever possible. That does take some capacity that we don't have all the capacity to do this in every space that we want, but we're inviting and asking people to be reflecting and making these changes. I guess what we're trying to do, and this goes back to this capacity, is feed that back. So the Center for Health Equity is taking those lessons and we're sharing them more broadly in our agency. And again, as I said at the beginning, this is imperfect and incomplete work, so I don't know that we're ever going to get it right. We're working to try to be able to be more facile enough to be able to keep improving. And it looks like
Senator Hayden, thank you for that. Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, thank you for that question, because as Assistant Commissioner Ayers said, a lot of our processes have been in place for a long time in a whole variety of areas, and they were put together with lots of good intentions, and it's some, certainly as state agencies, we have to be good stewards of resources, and we want to make sure that there's no fraud and abuse, and so we set all of these things in place, and they've been in place for many, many years. But now as we look at the policies behind that, we start to recognize that some of these unintentionally disadvantage some populations over others. So we are systematically going through a lot of our processes to see what's in place that disadvantages some populations over others, and if we can change those. And we are doing this in collaboration with the partners in the communities who are affected by those grants. For example, we know that to be good stewards of resources, when we fund organizations, we want to make sure that with grants that they have all systems in place, that they can really guarantee that every dollar spent is spent in the right place and have all of the controls. And we recognize, though, that organizations that are just getting started, that may not have all the capacity that larger agencies have, may not be able to do that. So they're at a competitive disadvantage for getting some of those grants. So we're looking at how can we do that differently? How can we still guarantee that funds are used appropriately, but not have all of the requirements that may get in the way of those small organizations? So we're really reanalyzing it, and it's going to be an ongoing process, because we're a large agency with lots of dollars and lots of interactions and lots of programs, so we're systematically going through that. You know, and for example, we're just looking at some of our programs and how we target, you know, targeting home ownership versus renters. That disadvantages some over others. So we're really looking at all of those, and it is a process that's ongoing. And if you see any things that are going on in the community or are the way we're doing it that we should look at, we'd be glad to do that. One of the things that has been very helpful with us with our links with the community and being honest with the fact that we have some systems in place that disadvantage some populations, they are coming forward and saying, you can do better, and this is what we see. Please act on this. We've given them permission to come and really challenge us and they're doing it in a respectful way to say, you can do this better, and we'll give you some input on how to do it better.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Ellinger.
Are there other questions? I'll ask a question here. It's somewhat related to Senator Hayden's question. I wanted to find out if you have specific ways that you are getting feedback from the communities that are affected by health disparities. Do you have opportunities built in to review progress, or in the grant-making progress, do you solicit feedback from groups who have applied to understand better, you know, what has happened that, you know, may be improved upon in the next round of grant processes from your perspective. I'm not necessarily saying from the perspective of the group, but that you could do differently to help groups be more successful. Ms. Ayers.
Madam Chair, there one of the things that has come up as we've strengthened, I think, our listening skills and with communities is the difference between evidence-based practices and practice-based evidence. And when we again, as I said, our expert agency, we want to make sure everything's got proof. And what we hear, though, is that much of the evidence is created in majority culture and that it may not be and often isn't effective with other sets of communities, and that we need to somehow balance the tension between wanting to be sure that the work and the funding goes to things that are effective. So an example of what we've done in this area is the SHIP grant program and the Tobacco-Free Communities grant program embarked upon a 12-month process with the tribes and American Indian community to begin to look at what kind of flexibility and what kind of approaches would they be wanting to advance and how rooted in what their understanding of what the changes that would make the most difference would be around physical activity and nutrition and tobacco use. And we've just learned a lot from that process, and it's been a very engaged process. So they've actually helped us design the next round of funding for them. Part of what we did as a result of that was have add staff that would work particularly with the communities. And we're asking the question of, if we don't have the evidence in your community, what kind of agreement can we develop together that will allow us to help create the evidence and evaluate practices that you believe will make a difference? That's just one example, but we have others.
Dr. Ellinger.
Madam Chair, one of the things that we learned in putting the Advancing Health Equity Report was just the process of what we learned in doing that report. And generally, as a department of experts, we look at the literature and we write out a draft and then bring it to the community and ask for their input. And we purposely flipped that around. We went to the community saying, we know that health equity issues and disparity issues exist. Tell us what we should put in this report. So we actually went out and got input from the communities, and from that then wrote the report, and then went back to the communities and say, did you hear your voice in this report? And if they didn't hear their voice in the report, we rewrote it. And so that was very powerful in improving our relationships with communities that we had not always such a good relationship with. And so that process of how we put together reports is starting to inform how we do other kinds of information gathering, how we do the reports, asking the community involved first to tell us what we should put in there, then write the report, and then get it back out for review. That's a small and subtle but very important change in how we are doing our business. It takes a lot of extra work. It takes a lot more different kinds of resources, so that we're obviously not going to be able to make that change in every part of our agency this quickly. But that's the goal that we're shooting at, to really give more power to the community to have input into these things before we make some decisions about the direction that we go.
Thank you. Senator Marty and then Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair and Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner, and it's been almost a year since this report came out, and you've been talking appropriately about what the agency's doing and how you're following up on it. Because of the fact that the report says, and Mr. Moa said earlier about the health in all policies thing, and your report talked about the impact of, I think, home ownership and housing in general, or poverty and other things like that, and all policies is not health department, obviously. I just was curious if anything is being done. I mean, part of the report is to educate internally and externally what causes health disparities and so on. Is there any outreach to other agencies, to elsewhere in society, to try and get to that? I'm just curious because it is that whole thing implies it's not just what you do at the health department, but what we do in everything else.
Dr. Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I'll start out, and I think Assistant Commissioner Ayers will add some additional things, but certainly we have understood that as state agencies, all state agencies have some role to play. And so I've been systematically working with all of my fellow commissioners. I have a TV show that I bring them on and talk about their role in advancing health. And so it's been really fun to have them on camera talking about the role of DEED and DNR and education and corrections and IRRB about their role in advancing health from their perspective and revenue and MMB. That, and then we brought all of the commissioners together to actually give them a primer on what health in all policies is and advancing health equity. So they're really on board. They understand their role that they play in health. And they've been asking us, you know, how we can help them as do their job with that health equity lens. So that's one point. Also, I've been really working with the University of Minnesota, recognizing that that's the other group, public agency within the state that really has a broad impact on the health of people in the state. And the president and the provost of the University of Minnesota recognize that their Department of English and their music school actually has some impact on health, and that they're thinking about how they can actually look at some of those social determinants of health in what they do in teaching and workforce development and research and community engagement. Those are just some of the things that we're doing. And we did have a cabinet meeting that really focused on the health and all policies approach with the fellow commissioners. I don't know if Commissioner Ayers.
Ms. Ayers.
Madam Chair, so one of the, on the other side of your handout of the questions is actually a synopsis of the Healthy Minnesota Framework for Action. And Healthy Minnesota Partnership has about 30 some partners that have representation from housing and community groups and transportation and pollution, and so all these other groups are there, and it's a combination of community and some state agency or local agency types of groups. They created the Framework for Action, which it, again, expanded the understanding of what creates health, and actually are tracking for our Healthy Minnesota 2020 vision areas around incarceration and home ownership and sense of safety and high school completion and business ownership by race, ethnicity, and are working in, this partnership has been working in subgroups. So a group of them actually, I think, approached members of this body to ask us to create a report around income and health to inform the conversation about minimum wage last year. That there's some, and I think that there is, again, another report that we're working on around paid parental leave and sick leave to bring the health considerations into the a broader set of policy arenas. We were here last year to talk about school discipline and possibly looking at health impact assessment around school discipline and in policies. And incarceration, the group of people who are partnering through this partnership were part of the group that helped advocate for Ban the Box, and are, I believe, some of them. Also, there was a meeting in November, and in that very meeting, which was the Healthy Minnesota Partnership, had a big community convening, they had a subgroup working on payday lending, a group working on active transportation, and a group working on sick and parental leave, all within the understanding of this is what's going to create health.
Thank you. Do you have a follow-up
Madam
question?
Chair, just a quick
Senator
comment.
Marty.
I'm impressed and pleased that you're not seeing it just as health department, because the nature of the report was it's not just health. Thanks.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On a follow-up to what Senator Marty is going, and I like to hear I like to hear the conversation about communities, you're getting in with communities. But what I'm not hearing is parents, consumers, those people that are in the trenches that perhaps should be. I know other states have some rules in place that say if we're going to have a task force or a committee, 50%, 50.1% are going to be those that are either receiving the services or those that are in the trenches that are working in those services, and they happen to be parents, and they happen to be, you know, consumers, people. And I'm glad to hear you, Commissioner, talk about communities, but could you define, you know, could you go a little deeper in the weeds just so I'm assured that, that the whole community is involved in this, and not to take a line from our former president's wife, but I do like to hear about the methodology behind how you came to a decision and was everybody at that table.
Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, we certainly recognize that who's at the table makes a difference in the decisions that are made. And we recognize that a lot of times where we have our meetings and when we have our meetings dictates who is there. We also recognize that, that communities are broad and one individual may not represent all of the community. So actually in our conversations, and I'll look to my co-presenters here on the table to give some examples of how we develop relationships with communities where we find people who actually represent a constituency, who have some connections with the community beyond just their individual presence, that they have relationships, that they are working on issues. So we try to identify those in our conversations with communities and have those people who then represent a constituency that they can then go back to that group and get the buy-in and input from that group. So we're looking at and certainly we have to recognize that a lot of those are volunteer positions, and we know that a lot of other people who are at the table are paid to do those meetings. So we're having to struggle with how do we, you know, really balance that table so that there's not an economic disadvantage for some populations. We're early in the process of doing that, but that is certainly one of the things that we have to do to get true representation in at where the decisions are made, that we have people who actually represent a constituency, and that they have some power at the table. And I'm not sure if my...
You didn't, Madam Chair?
Senator Hoffman?
Thank you. No, Commissioner, you didn't answer my question. I guess what I'd like to see is who are those folks that you're talking to? You know, one state, when I did compliance under 99457, one state made sure that 50% of the people they identified were either parents or people that were receiving the services. And they were there representing that certain hat they were. You know, I understand the constituent collection and such. But what I've seen in my history is we get these reports. Were they, and my question I'm throwing out there, and maybe it's a challenge, and please, you know, beat me on this challenge, is are we making these decisions in a bowl, you know, or are we truly devolving it down to that local interest and talking to the parent who can't get, you know, I think about the reports that were done in the 80s out of North Carolina, Dr. Carol Trivett and Dr. Carl Dunst, Supporting and Strengthening Families. They went right down to the family perspective on that and found out what it was were the barriers that were existing and why they weren't participating in early childhood programs. So, and I know I'm wrapping it around, but I'd really like to see that it's not just a bunch of bureaucrats sitting around a table making that decision. And I don't mean that in a negative sense, because Dr. Ellinger, the work you've done for many, many years from University of Minnesota and your assistant commissioner on MCHB group that she's part of is just remarkable. I guess that's helped me understand who are the people at that table.
Would it be helpful to give an example, or Dr. Peterson-Hickey, would you have examples of that works?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, I'll turn to my two colleagues, but we have lots of advisory committees that we already have lots of participation in from a variety of groups, you know, in particularly in maternal and child health, you know, parents of children with disabilities, but we want to make sure that it's even broader and that it represents a broader group. And I think Assistant Commissioner Ayers has some examples, and probably Melanie will also have some examples.
Dr. Peterson-Hickey?
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, I guess the example that I was thinking about as you were talking was the work that we did in engaging people to help us to write this Advancing Health Equity Report. people, you know, bring up things and they say, well, you're trying to implement this recommendation, but my reminder is that these aren't my recommendations or the health department recommendations, but these are actually the recommendations in the words of the 1,000 people representing all of the groups that you talked about that were part of pulling together that report. And just another comment on the question, you know, we're in process of building those kinds of relationships with communities as we pull the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative from the work of the liaisons within the Center for Health Equity. We're retooling, realigning the work of the liaisons to do just that. But there's a lot of work that needs to be done in communities. We say, you know, that interrupting process, part of the role of those liaisons is to create a space at the table, those decision-making places within the department. But we also need to do some work in preparing all of those constituencies to be able to step into those leadership and decision-making roles. And so it's ongoing work that will be continuing.
Ms. Ayers, do you have other specific? I know there's another question that Senator Eaton had, so I don't want to run out of time for that. So go ahead.
Madam Chair, I would just want to say, Senator Hoffman, that is the right question. I mean, I think that's the right question. It's one that we're asking ourselves constantly. What we have to do is develop the ability to do things in multiple different ways at the same time. We have a number of, like, advisory committees, for example, the Maternal Child Health Advisory Committee, and there are positions there for parents and for parents with children with disability, or, you know, there's, like, positions that are named in statute, actually, for who should be on that. But that's not enough. What we are doing now is that committee is now saying, is there a way that as a committee we can take some responsibility to create more forums and opportunities for conversation and input from people who don't want to be on a committee for 5 years, you know, but who want to participate in some conversations. So more of a multiple modes of entry into this process. The other barrier that we're challenged with is usually the people who can come to meetings, no matter what time of day they are the people who are paid to be there. And so we are challenged with some statutory restrictions that have made it hard to reimburse people who are not able to, you know, who don't have a job that says go to that meeting. So that's one of our other challenges. Thank you, Senator.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to address a little bit housing. I hadn't heard a whole lot about that, and I did note that the person who isn't here because of jury duty, Ms. Hurtado, anyway, that she does address poor housing conditions in her example of this young girl. And that's something I run into a lot in my community. And in fact, a lot of it is homelessness, period. But this group that we're talking about are unfortunately overrepresented in this group. And in the schools, we have so many kids who are homeless or in substandard housing. And I just see housing as a huge issue. And I'm wondering if the health department's been involved in anything to help work on that.
Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Senator Eaton, thank you. It highlights the fact that housing is a huge health issue. And certainly we are part of, as a department, are part of the ending homelessness sub-cabinet that we have been working on that. But we're also, the real benefit of the Health and All Policies approach is that we are in with our health care and our health partners, letting them know that health or that housing is an important health issue. It's an important issue in child abuse. It's an important issue in good nutrition. It's an important issue in education, which is a health issue. So we're bringing more partners from other disciplines to the housing conversations.
Okay.
Not only including housing, you know, as we're looking at it as a partner, but bringing you know, the health plans recognize that, that housing impacts their bottom line. It impacts the treatment and the care that their enrollees are getting. So they're now coming to the table to say, how can we help deal with the housing issue? So that's the benefit. From my perspective, is that we have a lot more advocates working on a whole variety of issues from a health perspective, be it corrections or housing or transportation or education. So there's a broader constituency there.
Thank you.
Well, we are almost to our 1 o'clock time. I just had one last question. I wondered if you have started to think about how you can do some, and maybe you've already developed this, some reporting to the community on how your efforts internally are turning out. I mean, how you see things happening, and so that they have a chance to comment on whether you're successful in your efforts or not. Commissioner Ellinger?
Madam Chair, certainly as Assistant Commissioner Ayers mentioned, we have a Healthy Minnesota partnership where we meet on a regular basis, where you have people from throughout the state and multiple disciplines. We're certainly working with our partners on a whole variety of issues. So we're doing a lot of work with race, ethnicity, and language data. And so we have lots of partners, and so they are working with us on a day-to-day basis of how that is going, and actually having reports to various community groups about how we are processing those kinds of information. We with the advisory committees, trying to give as much input back on the progress that we're making on this as we possibly can.
Okay. Thank you, and I appreciate your time today, and thank you for coming to present to us. I think we'll move to the next next item was to give an overview of the Department of Health efforts on Ebola, flu, and other infectious diseases. And Commissioner Ellinger, if you want to begin.
And as I talked about, we are an agency of experts, and that's why Chris Ayersman, who is our Director of Infectious Disease Epidemiology Prevention and Control, is here to give an overview of what's going on with Ebola and in influenza. We recognize that the health department deals with a whole variety of issues. Some are emerging issues like chronic diseases, and certainly the issue of advancing health equity is one of those. But there are also some things that have been traditional public health activities for a long time that we have done great work in addressing those, but need to continue to invest efforts into that, because there are infectious diseases are always there, always evolving, always challenging us. So I'll turn it over to Chris Ayersman to give you an update on Ebola and other infectious diseases, and be open to any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Welcome, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Chris Ayersman, and I'm the Director for Infectious Disease at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I appreciate the opportunity to give you an update on Ebola, influenza, and the other bad diseases that we're looking at. I think you're aware from the news headlines that last year was quite a year for infectious disease prevention and control. And I'd like to begin by talking about our response.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Can you just pull your microphone a little bit closer and speak more directly into it? Otherwise, it's hard to hear. Thank you.
Sure. So I'm Chris Ayersman, infectious disease. It was a bad year last year. So I'll begin with our Ebola response, and I'd like to do that by telling you a story. As you know, our agency began monitoring travelers who had arrived from the three Ebola-affected countries in late October of last year. And it was the Tuesday before Thanksgiving, late in the day. I confess I was thinking about the salted caramel chocolate pecan pie that I would be making to bring to Thanksgiving when I was notified by staff that they had contacted a newly arrived traveler, and this was their first contact with him. And when they reached him, he said, "I am so glad you called. I was just about to call 911. He had the symptoms of fever, vomiting, and diarrhea, which are all clinically associated with Ebola. And so what we did was we contacted the emergency medical services to arrange to have the patient picked up. We stayed on the line with him until they arrived. Then we contacted Unity Hospital, which is one of the four hospitals who had agreed to be a center for assessing and treating Ebola patients. And we let them know that they would be receiving a patient. Now, caring for a patient under investigation for Ebola is a huge commitment on the part of the hospital. Unity had to put their emergency room on divert in order to safely receive this patient. They had to establish a special route through their hospital so the patient could be safely transported to the intensive care isolation unit and not affect other patients. And they had invested hours and hours of staff time preparing and practicing putting on and taking off personal protective equipment. Once the patient was en route to the hospital, we at MDH sent a number of staff to Unity to provide technical assistance because caring for an Ebola patient is complex. Our laboratory staff assisted with specimen collection and packaging the specimen so it could be transported. The plan was that the specimen would be tested at the health department. At that time, we were one of 12 sites in the country that could do Ebola testing. We sent our medical director to the hospital to provide consultation, and infection prevention staff were there to make sure that the hospital staff were correctly using their personal protective equipment. And back at the health department, we were busy. We contacted the governor's office. We contacted the Centers for Disease Control as well as our local public health partners. We also prepared to interview the patient because we needed to know his activities and his contacts. We were preparing for the potential for a press conference in just a few hours. And then, because the emergency personnel had put on their personal protective equipment in the parking lot of the apartment building, many people had seen that. And so we needed to contact the apartment management and let them know that, you know, we were aware of what was happening and this did not pose a risk to their residents. And then we also worked with police to make sure that we had appropriately cordoned off the individual's apartment so that no one else could enter because of the potential for exposures. So this was all going on all evening, and it was 9:53 p.m., and in those stressful situations, you do remember the time very well. And that's when we got the call that the laboratory test was negative. While we weren't out of the woods yet, it was very good news. And the reason we weren't out of the woods is because you need to have a negative test after 72 hours of symptoms. And so this patient hadn't had symptoms for that long. So we tested the patient again on Wednesday, and it was thankfully negative. And then our laboratory staff were at the hospital at 7 a.m. on Thanksgiving Day to pick up the specimen so that they could test it right away that morning. And needless to say that when that specimen came back as negative, there were a large number of people who were truly thankful on Thanksgiving. If the test had been positive, it would have had a huge effect in terms of the workload and intensity that it generated. If you just think back to what happened in Dallas, that could have been Minnesota with a bit more planning and organization. Our experience with Lassa fever in April of 2014 taught us that we had 169 contacts for that patient that needed follow-up. So if this case had been positive, it would have resulted in a huge workload. And this case was not the end of our response. We've had four patients under investigation for Ebola. So each of the four hospitals has had the ability to test. And unfortunately, we don't have very good timing because the last case was evaluated on Christmas Eve. So clearly, our Ebola response represents more than our usual infectious disease activity. And if I could use an acute care analogy, it's really a trauma response of for infectious disease. Over a 2.5-month period from October through early December, we had 40 staff who were working full-time on Ebola. That included communication staff, our public health laboratory, emergency preparedness staff, our legal unit staff, as well as the staff in the infectious disease division. And we currently have three full-time staff who are just working to monitor the 50 or so travelers that we currently have that are being monitored. Up until this point, we've had 216 people who have completed that 21-day monitoring. So that's one reason, or that is the reason, why we've requested deficiency funding. The base budget that was passed last year for MDH did not anticipate this type of response. So that's a little descriptive, and I'll tell you, my family got frozen pie for for Thanksgiving. So that gives you a little bit of a summary of kind of our Ebola activities in a story form. And then what I'd like to do is I'll go on to the other infectious diseases and I can answer questions.
Sure, that would be good. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Senator Nelson, did you have a question about...
Madam Chair, I have a series of questions about Ebola, and so my question is if we want to take those now or if you want to wait until you get through the other infectious diseases. But this is my questions are particularly about Ebola.
Ms. Erisman, do you have a lot more about the... or would you like to finish the complete picture of infectious diseases, or do you want to stop and then go back to that?
I'm happy to do whatever is best for the committee, Madam Chair. I have Ebola, norovirus, mumps, and some sexually transmitted diseases. But we can talk about Ebola now if you'd like.
Okay. Senator Nelson, why don't you go ahead?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for the description. I can tell it was certainly on all of our minds during this time. It's a terrifically contagious disease. And I have two lines of questions. One has to do with the transmission, and that is the timeline, and you nailed the date I had down here too, was December 24th. So obviously looking at the data you gave us today, 47 travelers still being monitored, that means there have been 47 some possible ability to have contacted Ebola within the last 3 weeks. Is that right?
Ms. Erisman?
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, yes, so we currently have 47 individuals who are under monitoring. That means that they returned from travel to the three Ebola-affected countries. They're currently at low but not zero risk, and so we're monitoring them for any symptom of fever or any other change in their health status. So we anticipate that we will continue doing this monitoring until Ebola is no longer occurring in West Africa, so probably for the next year. So in terms of, when are we out of the woods, I think we have quite a ways to go before that happens.
Thank
Senator
you. Nelson?
And Madam Chair, and so the question is, of those travelers who have come back or who are here visiting, who have been to those Ebola-affected countries, are they... voluntarily quarantined, or are they out potentially infecting other Minnesotans?
Ms. Erisman?
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, these individuals are currently voluntarily participating in the monitoring program. They're individuals that do not have any symptoms. And so what we know about Ebola is that if an individual does not have symptoms, they're not infectious. So these individuals are able to go about their normal activities, but they're checking in with us each day. They have to monitor their temperature twice daily, and if they would have any change in symptoms, they need to immediately isolate themselves. So, yes, they're participating in society, but they're not at risk to the general public at this point. It's only if they have a change in symptoms that would be a concern. And then just to clarify, if you think back to the Dallas situation with Mr. Duncan, when we look at where there was the opportunity for transmission, it was only very late in the course of his illness, and those individuals that were providing very intense care to him. So his family members, the EMS personnel, all those folks that had been exposed to him before he was hospitalized did not develop Ebola. Just to clarify.
So just one.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one further follow-up to that. So of the 147 or how many or 200 that you have monitored, how many of those are from what one might call secondary potential exposure? In other words, someone who had been in those highly infected countries were on monitoring and then developed symptoms, and then it was all of going out to that second tier, in other words, the people that they had contact with.
Ms. Erisman?
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, actually all of the individuals that we're currently monitoring would be considered sort of a primary potential for exposure. So they're being monitored based on their history of travel to the three Ebola-affected countries, and we've not been in a position at this point where we've needed to go beyond that first ring, if you will, of monitoring, because we have not had any cases of Ebola.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
And so what is the cost then? I know we have a total cost request or a budget request here for these unanticipated expenses regarding highly infectious diseases. But if you could determine the cost of the Ebola prevention, detection, I'd like to know what the cost is totally. And then if you have an idea on what is the cost per case, so the cost to monitor each case. I know there's an hour-long interview to start with. There's daily check-ins, that type of thing. Can you kind of give me some of those numbers or rough estimates?
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, our overall estimates for what this was costing the agency as we anticipated moving to June of this upcoming year were close to $1 million. And as I mentioned, we currently have three full-time staff who are doing monitoring. We have staff that are on call 24/7. These individuals need to have access to someone 24/7 if they have any questions or concerns about the monitoring or their status. We have medical personnel that are on call 24/7 because obviously they do have a change in their health status. We need to have people who are ready to respond and assist them with that. And then in addition, I guess if we think about our total response to Ebola, it included legal staff, costs with the Attorney General's office, communications staff, emergency response personnel working with the hospitals, and then our infectious disease staff. So if you'd like us to kind of put together more detailed information, we can do that, but I can't do it right on the top of my head.
I understand that. That'd be helpful.
Senator Nelson.
And then the final line of questioning is thinking about those costs then that translate down into the hospitals. So the department has incurred $1 million cost. What about those four designated hospitals? How are they being compensated for the costs that they've incurred, and what might those costs be? I have an idea, but I'd like to know how is the funding getting to reimburse those hospitals for those costs?
Ms. Erzman.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, at this point, the deficiency request that has been submitted was looking at the agency's cost, but I can tell you that working with the hospitals and the Hospital Association, we know that these four hospitals have invested a lot of money. And at this point, they're estimating probably $1 million each just to be prepared. Many of them had to do construction on their facilities to make sure that they were fitted appropriately for the infection control aspects of Ebola. So at this point, and then they obviously have ongoing costs related to training and maintaining preparedness of their staff. So at this point, we're aware of at least that. We're certainly waiting to see what federal resources will be, but it's fair to say that the hospitals have a great commitment in terms of their response, and at this point, they have not received anything from the state in terms of funding.
Senator Hayden, good. Did you have a question?
Well, I was trying to get in while Senator Nelson was going down her process because she stole a little bit of the questions that I wanted to ask, but I'm glad that they were asked. I think in addition to the hospital question that I wanted to ask, which I think that you've answered, that you haven't given them anything in your funding request, hadn't requested anything for them, so I think that we may want to think about that because they are partners in this process, and without, I mean, it feels a little top-down that we're not thinking about our providers in terms of what they might be able to need to actually do the work that we need to keep people safe and then to make people healthy if they're infected. So I haven't been involved in this conversation, but I would hope that we would think about that and have the Department of Health support that. In addition to that, I think about the issue of who gets the patient from where they are to the hospital, and I know that that's the ambulance folks, and what do they need to have retrofitted, and what kind of training do they need, and what is their cost? And I don't know if that's the system that would pay for that or how that financing works, but maybe that's more of a statement along with that in this kind of system, right, of dealing with someone who we think potentially could be infected, from the early voluntary monitoring because you've been in a country, to you are symptomatic and someone needs to come and get you and take you to one of the four designated hospitals, to making sure that the hospitals have trained staff, the equipment that is needed, and then the cost, including taking a couple of rooms, kind of offline in perpetuity to be prepared for that. So I think when we think about this, there is a lot of cost that is incurred by a lot of folks. So I would hope that as we think about this moving forward, this session, that we really get your support and continue. And I'm sure we have, but I'm a little concerned that though I know that the Department of Health has incurred a lot of cost in dealing with this, that we work in tandem with the whole community of folks that have to deal with this and ensure that we're making sure that they're compensated as well.
Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, I'm the, as part of being a health commissioner, I'm part of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, the health commissioners in all the states. And this is certainly a national issue, the costs that have been there, particularly for the hospitals that have been, or the airports that have done the screening, the hospitals that are taking these individual patients, the transportation, and there's huge costs that are engaged. So we are actively engaged with our federal partners in their requests for emergency funding, and the hospital needs are part of that conversation for sure. We recognize that there are lots of costs, there are lots of players in this, and we want to make sure that we leverage the resources as best we can to meet the needs on an ongoing basis.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Ellinger, you started to address what my question was going to be. We have four designated hospitals, so obviously they're going to need some federal money because this really is a federal issue. The Department of Health made the request based on, in your call-out box here, federally required activities, so I'm hoping we're going to turn to the feds, and because there has been some appropriation at the federal level, and so I would hope that we would put the deficiency funding, I don't want to say on hold, because your department did good work and should be made whole for that work. However, you did call out that it was federally required, and so I want to know what you're doing to put our place in line for the federal money. We very early on realized that because of our Liberian population, we were at a greater risk than a number of other states, and I think wisely our Department of Public Safety, Department of Public Health said we are going to be on the front line and we're going to be ready for this. It turns out that level of response was prudent and necessary, but most other states aren't in our kind of position. States where there's a lot of interchange at airports, yes. And so I would hope that you would advocate for us strongly at the federal level instead of just leaning on taxpayers here in Minnesota.
Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, actually we are working with our federal partners, and in fact there's a meeting tomorrow where we have just gathered all of the information from our department on all of the various areas to make that available to the people who are actually making some considerations for where the funding goes. We've certainly been working with our congressional delegation to make sure that our needs of our state, where we do have a large Liberian population, are articulated to CDC and the Assistant Secretary for Prevention at the federal level. We are actively engaged with that, with our partners, and with our congressional delegation to make those needs known.
Thank you.
Ms. Erzman?
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, I do want to make a couple of points. One is that we have, the agency has received at this point $122,000 for monitoring. Our deficiency request was reduced by that amount, because that came in. But I also want to point out that funding is currently being split between the Department of Health, Hennepin County, and Ramsey County, which are counties that are also helping us with the monitoring. And at this point, it's completely insufficient to cover our costs. In fact, we're going to have to do a sort of a backwards approach, because if we had the staff that are full-time and charge their salaries to that exclusively right now, we wouldn't have enough money when we got to March to cover other staff that are being pulled from other programs. We're rotating through so that we aren't you know, taking away from any one program. So we certainly are very mindful of being a good steward of state resources, but I think it's important to keep in mind at this point that our division is over 85% federally funded, and all those funds are designated for specific activities, and so we don't have a lot of flexibility. And then one last comment, and that is we did these activities not because they were federally mandated. We did these activities because they were the right things to do to protect Minnesota from Ebola. And we are currently using the CDC recommendations and guidelines for our monitoring. But I do want to be clear that we're doing them because it's the right thing to do, not just because it's a federal activity.
Senator Benson,
Madam Chair,
a brief question?
Obviously, our medical community does things because they're the right thing to do. Unity Hospital took on regional responsibility because they were uniquely prepared among their regional partners to take on the Ebola response. So absolutely, I understand that. But I also understand that the federal government is putting money forward for this. And Minnesota should not take a deferential position and say, no, it's okay, we can afford to do this, and let other states off the hook. You did the work. You deserve the credit, absolutely. But the federal government can help us support this.
I think I'll have you move on to the other infectious diseases. We only have about a little over 5 minutes left. And I think it sounds like the funding to support the response at all levels, the hospital, you know, the concerns from staff in the hospitals. We have testimony from Minnesota Nurses Association that there are still concerns about the provision of the proper equipment and training. So it seems like this is an issue that we would want to have maybe further discussion on with you to make sure that all the parties are getting a chance to express their needs. So. But I'll have you move on to the other infectious diseases, and like I say, we have about 5 minutes left. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I can tell you that just as Ebola was leveling off and we were hoping to catch our breath, influenza hit. And so we've had a crazy early widespread and severe influenza season this year. And there are two reasons for that. First is that the strain that's circulating, H3N2, whenever that's the predominant strain, we see more severe disease in the young and the elderly. And then this year's vaccine, the strain, the H3N2 strain that was included in this year's vaccine, does not match well with the circulating strain, making it less effective. And so as a result of this, we have seen a very severe season. We've had 619 schools report influenza-like illness, and the week before Christmas, we had 315 schools report outbreaks, and that's higher than we saw during the 2009-2010 pandemic. Our lab has been swamped with specimens for testing. The Monday before Christmas, they received 289 specimens to be tested, which was an all-time daily record for flu. We've had 135 long-term care facilities that are reporting outbreaks, and we've had over 1,200 hospitalizations. And our average age of hospitalization is 74, which just reinforces that this outbreak is really affecting the elderly. We've had 4 pediatric deaths thus far this year, sadly. The department continues to promote the usual messages of getting vaccinated, good hand washing, respiratory hygiene, staying home when you're sick, sleep, and good nutrition as ways to prevent and lessen transmission from flu. Then in addition to flu or influenza, we have seen our worst norovirus outbreak. And norovirus is what most people refer to as stomach flu. We don't like to use that term because it's confusing, but nonetheless, it's the most common cause of gastrointestinal illness. We've had 43 outbreaks so far this year, just in November and December. And so that means that this is, in the last 15 years, this is second only to 2006-2007. So needless to say, the foodborne staff are very busy. I'll just mention mumps because I can tell you when I talk to my dad, this is the most interesting thing he thinks that I've done all year, and that's because the National Hockey League has had mumps in its players. We ruled out 250 suspect cases of mumps this year. We've had 23 confirmed were probable cases, and we did have cases in members of the Minnesota Wild. And then finally, we were specifically asked for an update on our sexually transmitted disease program. And in short, I can tell you that the number of cases of disease have increased over the last decade. Chlamydia is our number one infectious disease and has had a 65% increase between 2003 and 2013. We had 19,000 cases last year, and every single county in Minnesota had cases. So far this year, and just up through October, we've had 15,000 cases of chlamydia. Gonorrhea is on the same increase, a 14% increase over the decade, and we had over 3,000 cases of gonorrhea so far this 2014. And then primary and secondary syphilis, a 275% increase over the decade. And as of October, we had seen 515 cases of syphilis. So in summary, I'd just like to say that we're very busy in the infectious disease area, working hard to protect Minnesotans from infectious disease. As one infectious disease expert said, infectious diseases are a continuing threat. No one should think of 2014 as an aberration. This is the new normal.
Thank you. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How's the avian flu season looking? A few years ago, we had quite a scare, and it's going to be approaching.
Ms. Erzman?
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, we're continuing to monitor for avian influenza. We are not seeing cases in the human population, but avian influenza has been identified in flocks and, in fact, was identified in poultry in the United States. So we're monitoring that. We're aware of it, but we're not seeing cases of, for instance, H5N1 right now in anyone in Minnesota. So that's something that we continue to monitor, but it's not a present concern.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Well, I think we will wrap up there, and I really appreciate your coming and presenting. I think there's some information there that would warrant more discussion, and perhaps we would have more discussion later in the session. But really appreciate your time today, and this concludes our session for today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.